Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode has been brought to you by Sake Man, a group of sake superheroes bringing sake to the world.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. This happens to be the last week that we're going to do live recordings in the studio at Heritage Radio Network because, as you may have known, I've heard there's been a national emergency in the U.S. due to the COVID-19 coronavirus that has really shook the New York City food and beverage industry. Restaurants are now capped at 50% capacity. And in Roberta's Pizza, where Heritage Radio Network has a little station alongside, I can tell you that looking out into one of the dining areas right now, just outside of the station, is definitely less than 50% capacity, whether that has anything to do with just people not wanting to go out, social distancing, or... But it doesn't seem to be the same city that it was just a week ago, that's for sure. Jeet, our Heritage Radio Network engineer here, Jeet Suresh Paul, how has your life changed? I know that you're still working for here for the next week, but what's going on with you?
So pretty much like you said, there's definitely been a change in the amount of people on the streets and on the subways. Both my other jobs are going into remote mode.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them will be relatively easier, but I also teach, and teaching something as hands-on as sound engineering over the internet is not going to be as fun for the students or for me, but we'll have to make it work somehow.
Well, that's really great that you can do that. And I'm really like proud of all the efforts that people are making to,
definitely.
So that's awesome.
Otherwise, pretty much the same, you know.
That's just good.
I told you before the air that I went to a Vietnamese food place yesterday night and had some awesome fried rice. Yeah.
So. Oh, yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, you know, there's been like so many efforts to trying to like help and support food business and restaurants, and then there's also restaurants that have decided to voluntarily close.
Right.
So it's a lot of a conflicting. Wisdom out there and conflicting impulses to help the greater good.
I don't know if you heard, but I live in Jersey City, and they have a 10 p.m. curfew for bars and clubs and liquor stores. And so it's definitely going to be affecting.
That's going to affect for sure.
Yeah.
If it's not a total shutdown soon. We also know that in the last month, that Chinatown has been particularly hit in Chinese restaurants just across the country. Mm. And that's like totally unfair and totally total stereotype.
Yeah, because, very strange.
Yeah, it's just really not cool. So that's why I'm delighted to have a guest on whose book I've been so enamored by, and I did not expect to be talking to her about coronavirus at first at all. And we're not going to be talking about that the whole time at all. But my guest today is a veteran food journalist. She is the food reporter at the Globe and Mail, that's in Canada, since 2015. And her first book just came out a year or so ago called Chop Suey Nation, The Surprising History and Vibrant Present of Small Town Chinese Restaurants from Victoria, BC to Fogo Island, Newfoundland. And it is Anne Hui. Hi.
Hi, Kathy. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us. And you're at home in whereabouts do you live?
I'm in Toronto.
Toronto. Awesome. So when this book first came out, I mean, it was so exciting to see somebody who wrote a Chinese-Canadian food history. And tell me a little bit about how this book came about. And, you know, I know that you did some reporting in your work. So what was the first inspiration behind this book?
So this book has been the product of a few years, actually. It's it all started in 2016 when I wrote a story for the Globe and Mail that basically detailed a cross-country trip that I took for the Globe. Mm-hmm. I pitched this idea to my editors at the time that they should let me drive across Canada, all the way from the West Coast, so from Victoria, B.C., all the way east to Fogo Island, which is this teeny tiny little island off of the eastern edge of Canada. You know, drive across the country 18 days, visiting as many small towns as possible, meeting as many Chinese restaurant owners as possible, and try to figure out something that I think a lot of people have wondered kind of off and on over the years, which is, why is there a Chinese restaurant in pretty much every small town, certainly here in Canada, but I know it's not unique to us here in Canada and across North America, really.
Right.
So it all came out of that road trip.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I had no idea, actually, until I started reading this book, that it was such a personal story to you and your family. And not only was it a personal, it was like a gripping, like suspenseful and poignant story that had me like in tears. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Well, as I say in the book, and as I've talked about elsewhere, you know, I didn't even realize when I first set out on this journey, definitely not when I first set out on that road trip, that this was going to be such a personal story.
Right.
You know,
you were like, I'm a reporter.
I pitched this idea in like early, maybe spring of 2016. And the idea was to answer those questions like, why is there a Chinese restaurant in every single small town across Canada? You know, who are these people who run these restaurants? What are their lives like? And all the while, even as I'm taking this trip, you know, a lot of their stories seemed so almost foreign to me. You know, and I was approaching it in very much a journalistic, almost anthropological way because a lot of the lives and stories that I was hearing sounded so different from my own experience as someone who had grown up in, you know, major urban centers and mostly surrounded by quite large Chinese-Canadian communities. But it was only after the fact, it was only after my story in the Globe and after my road trip that I learned that I actually had this really personal connection to the subject matter. Mm-hmm. I learned that my own parents, actually, unbeknownst to me, had run one of these Chinese restaurants before I'd even been born.
Oh, my goodness. I want to get back to this story. It's such a special, beautifully written story. You mentioned all these small Chinese restaurants in these small towns that are dotted throughout the country in Canada and certainly also in the U.S. In light of the coronavirus, we are worrying a lot more about these mom-and-pop restaurants that are now targeted by, you know, basically bigotry. And, like, in New York City, in Chinatown, far before like the social distancing movements of the like last week or so, a lot of Chinese restaurants were reporting a very low turnouts. They're endangered. A bunch of them closed temporarily due to low attendance. What is that like in Canada or over the last month or two?
Yeah, it's a bit of a complicated one to answer because it's still evolving.
Yeah.
And even after, you know, the closest comparison that we have right now would be the SARS outbreak. You know, even after SARS happened and it hit us here in Toronto quite hard, it was quite a while before we were able to get actual data and figures that could accurately reflect exactly what had happened.
Right.
And so I think the actual situation is going to take a while to kind of, it's going to take a while to shake out and properly assess. I know just anecdotally, though, based on, you know, my own experiences over the last few months of going out to eat in Chinese restaurants and then just hearing experiences of friends and other people across the city, I mean, we've definitely noticed a very similar pattern to what you've just talked about in New York. You know, I know that there are a lot of restaurants that my husband and I frequent here in the city that would normally, on any other, you know, given day or year, would be packed or have lineups that we've been able to easily get into and have the restaurants be three quarters empty. The exact reason for it is a little bit, I think it's complicated
right.
to answer where this is coming from. I mean, I think it's too simple to say that it's, at least here in Toronto, that it's directly attributable only to racism or only to xenophobia. And the reason I say that is because a lot of these restaurants that I'm frequenting and seeing these lower numbers in are ones that generally rely on, for a large part of their customer base, you know, Chinese communities themselves. These are restaurants that typically have really large Chinese yep. customer bases. Mm. And so in a lot of cases, it seems to be Chinese customers themselves who are maybe deciding to stay home, mm-hmm. Maybe deciding to self-isolate. So I think that's an important nuance that needs to be
right.
in the conversation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know, again, anecdotally, just, you know, based on being having Chinese relatives and you know, talking to my mom and my aunts and my uncles and things, I know that they've been choosing to stay home a lot more over the last number of months. And I think that, you know, you talked about social distancing earlier, and I think that for a lot of my peer group and a lot of the people I work with and spend time with, for a lot of us, this idea of social distancing is only something that we've only really started to do over the last week or so aggressively. Yeah. But I know that for people in my mom's generation, especially people who are listening to like a lot of Chinese language media or who have spent a lot of time over the last few months, you know, reading headlines coming directly from China and Hong Kong, where they've been really serious and really aggressive about this kind of social distancing and self-isolating stuff for many, many months now. They've already been kind of, as much as I hate to say it, kind of ahead of the curve on some of that stuff. So I think that's definitely a factor. But on the other hand, I mean, have we all seen, I think, the same kind of racism, either whether it through social media directed at Chinese communities over COVID and coronavirus? Have we all kind of heard some of these messages and seen these memes going around? Absolutely. And you know, are they disturbing? Absolutely.
Yeah. And thank you so much for pointing out that a lot of this is anecdotal and observational. And it is hard to really grasp what it is until we have more data. So that's totally fair. I mean, what we can say, though, is it's a very scary time to be in a restaurant business. And
I don't want to I definitely don't want to come across as saying that racism and xenophobia isn't a part of it. I think that, as with all things, you know, history and context is really, really, really important. And so when we see memes or when we see rumors or when we see kind of racist messaging out there talking about kind of how certain communities may be to blame, or I think we've all seen that really kind of disturbing, like, bat soup rumor circulating quite a while back. I mean, it's impossible not to take into context or take into account, you know, the fact that these kinds of messages come with a very specific history.
Right.
And in the case of Canada and the United States, the history for early Chinese immigrants is that, you know, these are very similar to the messages that that were used initially to keep, you know, Chinese immigrants out of North America. These are messages that kind of echo the yellow peril messages. These ideas that, you know, the Chinese needed to be kept out of the U.S., that, you know, discriminatory policies and anti-Chinese Chinese policies needed to be put in place here in Canada because the Chinese were somehow unclean or that they carried with them disease. You know, in my research for the book, I remember wading through newspaper articles right here in Canada that openly speculated, you know, in the early 20th century that Chinese restaurants were serving rats.
Oh my goodness.
Or that they were serving, you know, who knows what other kind of roadkill, and that they were questionable kind of sanitary practices and all of this stuff. And so when we hear about, you know, some of these kinds of questions see this kind of like behavior being targeted now at Chinese restaurants, it's hard not to think about that history.
Yeah, absolutely. You've written a lot about the history specific to Canada, and you know, a lot of folks might know a little bit about Chinese American food and how it evolved from the migrant workers who are, you know, as the story goes, a lot of them were from, you know, Taishan area in China. And then, you know, they were sort of forced into this industry because they were shut out of other lines of work, and then, you know, just sort of forge a cuisine. What is exactly the story behind the roots of Chinese Canadian cuisine? Like when, where, and tell us a little bit about that.
It's actually, it's quite a similar story here in Canada to what happened in the United States, but our timing is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And there were probably a few events that maybe distinguish our history from yours a bit. So in Canada, a lot of the first Chinese men arrived here the very first Chinese men arrived here in Canada in the mid-19th century.
That's this much
would
later.
Have been around okay. 1858. Mm-hmm. And many of them first arrived to take part in the Gold Rush, which mm-hmm. is very, very similar to the history in the United States. And then later, many more, tens of thousands of Chinese men were recruited to Canada as cheap labor to help build the railroad.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so these were men who had been specifically recruited, sought out, and brought to Canada because, you know, we needed that cheap source of labor, and they needed people who would be willing to do the most dangerous work, uh-huh. basically. So any jobs or any tasks that involved, say, dynamite or crawling into very small places, those were the jobs that were given to these Chinese men. And in most cases, these men were paid, you know, $1 a day versus the $1.50 or $2 a day that the white local men would have been paid. And so that's the history for most of the very earliest Chinese men who arrived here. Mm-hmm. Of course, as soon as they had arrived, or not long after they had arrived, and not long after this work that they'd been originally recruited for had dried up, there were concerns that all of these men who were suddenly here were going to take away jobs from locals, or other jobs away from locals. Mm-hmm. And so you saw in a very short period all of these different policies put in place here in Canada designed to either push out these men who were already here or to prevent others from coming. Mm-hmm. And so we had here in Canada the Chinese Exclusion Act, which actually barred Chinese men from coming into the country altogether. We had that followed many years of a head tax that saw Chinese men who wanted to come into this country having to pay, in many cases, exorbitant fee in order to come. And so you had all of these policies in place. We had rules that actually prevented Chinese men from entering the general workforce. So, mm-hmm. you know, any kind of a white collar or what most would consider the more desirable work was mm-hmm. actually prohibited for Chinese men from entering. And so basically, the Chinese men who were left here in Canada were left with very, very, very few options. Basically, all they were left with was what was considered women's work at the time. So that left them jobs in laundromats, mm-hmm. in convenience stores, or in restaurants. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where all of this comes from. That's right. Where this history, this long history of Chinese restaurants across this country kind of all started.
Amazing. I want to talk a lot about some of the fruits of this history right after a quick little commercial break. But some of the unique dishes that we don't find in America are fried macaroni, a Quebec Chinese Canadian specialty. So hang in right there, and we'll be right back chatting more with Anne Huy.
This episode is brought to you by Sake Man. What is Sake Man? Sake Man are judo athletes wearing Lucha Libre-inspired masks that act as sake heroes. This team of athletes moonlight as sake educational professionals spreading sake to the world. Learn more about their mission and their favorite sakes at saketotheworld.com. That's saketotheworld.com.
All right, we're back chatting more with Anne Huy. She is the author of Chop Suey Nation. And Anne, you mentioned that chop suey is sort of this, you use it as a sort of moniker for all the Chinese food that is fake, or you were raised to think was like not so authentic Chinese food.
Yeah, for me, chop suey is just kind of an easy shorthand for describing, as you said, this whole kind of repertoire of dishes that are known as or sold as really worldwide as Chinese food. And yet, if you were to actually visit China or ask, you know, most people of Chinese descent about, they would tell you that they're not actually made in China creations.
But then you going on this long road trip across the country, and certainly with family discoveries, you have a slightly different take on it now. Or what did you learn about this cuisine that was different than what you were raised to believe about it?
Yeah, I mean, I come from a Chinese Canadian family. You know, mm-hmm. I grew up going to a lot of, quote, authentic Chinese or mostly Cantonese restaurants in the Vancouver area when I was growing up. And so anytime I would come across this other kind of Chinese food, you know, the chicken balls with the bright red sauce or the chop suey or the
egg roll,
you know, lemon chicken, mm-hmm. I was always kind of mystified by this stuff. And I really kind of internalized the messages that I heard from everyone around me. And by everyone, I mean, you know, my Chinese relatives and the Chinese restaurant workers around me and whatnot, that this was fake Chinese. I thought that right. This was, you know, this Chinese food was lesser than
right, right.
Mm-hmm. The authentic stuff that we ate at home or at the restaurants in Chinatown. But when I went out and I started talking to these Chinese restaurant owners in small towns who were serving this chop suey stuff, and I learned the history of this cuisine, you know, this was food that, as I mentioned earlier, was created by these first Chinese men who arrived in Canada and the United States. These men weren't trained cooks, right? Mm-hmm, they mm-hmm. were, as we said earlier, they had been working on the railroad or as part of the gold rush. They didn't necessarily know their way around a kitchen. They probably didn't know how to cook authentic Chinese food, even if they wanted to. Mm. They wouldn't have had Chinese customers to serve, you know, the authentic stuff too. And they wouldn't have had access to Chinese ingredients, again, even if they wanted to cook this authentic stuff. And so these Chinese men who were already facing, you know, great discrimination, all kinds of very real challenges in starting up these businesses, they figured out this way to kind of create this cuisine that was appealing to local palates. You know, they were a little bit exotic in that they were a little bit reminiscent of kind of Chinese-ish flavors, mm-hmm. a little bit exotic, but familiar enough, you know? So yep. with the chicken or with the beef, they would throw in a little bit of ketchup. or maybe throw things in the deep fryer to get these textures that, that maybe locals were more accustomed to. And so it was this kind of mix between a little bit exotic and a little bit familiar, you know, a little bit sweet, a little bit sour, a little bit crunchy or crispy, and yet tender. It was just really kind of cool improvisation. It's this cuisine that really shows this incredibly industrious entrepreneurial spirit, and I think there's something really beautiful in that.
And look how beloved it is. I mean, it's just that's telling of itself. You're absolutely right. One of the dishes I was interested by, and actually you mentioned the meatballs. I don't know that. What did you say again? Chicken balls?
Oh, chicken balls.
Yeah. Yes. Tell me about those.
Chicken balls are a dish, and I can't say that it's unique to Canada, though it does certainly seem to be more popular here in Canada than in the United States. It is a dish that I say with great shame was not familiar with until probably my 20s. So as I said, you know, I grew up in Vancouver. I didn't eat a lot of this chopped suey cuisine growing up. But after moving to Toronto and after becoming maybe a little bit more acquainted with this chopped suey type cuisine, definitely here in Ontario, definitely here in Toronto, chicken balls is one of the, like, classic chop suey dishes. It is a deep fried ball of dough that has on the inside stuffed into it usually a morsel or kind of bit of chicken, and then the whole thing, and imagine the ball is about the size of a fist, is dunked into this bright red, shiny, sweet and sour sauce.
Whoa.
And it is beloved here in Toronto and really across the country.
Wow. Okay. That's one thing I don't know that I've had before. By the way, I love, Anne, how you write in the first chapter or so about how you first discovered these Chinese foods when you were in school and there was like a Chinese culture day, and that's when you were like, oh, you're super excited to share your culture, and you're like, wait, what are these foods? Because it was like the chop suey type of cuisine, and I can totally relate. I had a similar situation growing up too. So so chicken balls, one of those dishes. Another dish that I thought was really interesting, and I don't know that we've seen much of in the U.S., was the Chinese-Canadian fried macaroni, which looks sort of like fried noodles, but elbow. Is that what it is?
Yeah, that seems to be a Quebec specialty because, again, you know, until I took this road trip, there apparently were a lot of these kind of chop suey dishes across the country that I had never heard or seen before. And that's something I learned on this road trip is that, you know, not only are there Canadian-specific chop suey dishes that are going to be distinct from the ones that you guys have in the United States, but there are also even just kind of regionally specific across Canada chop suey dishes, and fried macaroni was one of them. I'm not going to try to say the name in French because I will butcher it, but it basically translates loosely into Chinese macaroni, and it's like almost any other stir-fried
it looks like a noodle
dish that you might get
in
a Chinese restaurant. Yeah, but they use elbow macaroni.
Well, I mean, it does speak to what you're saying, this industrious, resourceful, and, you know, creative spirit throughout throughout the regions and making something that was enduring. So let's talk a little bit about your personal connection, because this was so fascinating to read about. You know, going around the country, you found out that all these, you know, these families got into the food business, restaurant business for various reasons. And then you discovered that after doing this initial article and initial road trip that your family did as well. And you shared the story about that. What was it like to discover that?
Yeah, so my parents came to Canada in the 1970s separately. So my dad and my mom both arrived in Canada in 1974, I believe. Mm-hmm. And for most of my young life, my dad did work in restaurants. He owned a series of restaurants in my younger years, but they were what we called, quote, Western restaurants.
Okay.
And businesses. You know, he would cook, you know, roast beef and lasagnas, and he later had a catering company where he would cater these large buffets and weddings and that kind of thing with mm-hmm. huge, you know, cold cut platters and fettuccine Alfredo. So that's the kind of food that I had always associated with my dad cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But around the time after my initial chop suey road trip had happened, again, this is back in 2016, around that time was when my dad was also initially diagnosed with cholangiocarcinoma, which is a kind of cancer. Mm-hmm. It's cancer of the bile duct. It's not a good cancer, or at least it wasn't in his case. And basically what it meant was that I was spending a lot of time back in Vancouver visiting with him, just trying to be with him as much mm-hmm. as possible, flying back and forth between Toronto and Vancouver. And so during one of these visits back home with my dad, you know, I was talking to him about his history. I was talking to him about, you know, what his life had been like before, you know, I was born. And it was in that conversation that he actually started talking about this restaurant that he had owned before I was born called the Legion Cafe. And as I'm asking him more and more questions about it, he reveals to me that the Legion was, in fact, a Chinese/Western restaurant. And when he showed me the menu, it was, you know, just like the menus of all of these other restaurants that I had visited on this road trip across the country. You know, it was chop suey, it was almond chicken, it was lemon chicken and fried rice. And, you know, seeing that menu and finally learning this history, you know, all these decades later, was really stunning to me, because it made me realize, I think for the first time, or properly appreciate just how little I really knew about my dad's life, but also just our family's history. You know, I hadn't really taken the time up until this point where suddenly there was this very real and urgent timeline to ask him questions about his life and to ask him about how it was that he and we had somehow wound up here.
Amazing. I mean, why do you think it's important, though, to share these stories from your dad's, as well as the other small restaurants serving Chinese food throughout Canada?
I think that as relatively recent immigrants, and also as, you know, people of color, people whose histories in North America, certainly my family's history in Canada, are a little bit shorter, quite a bit shorter than what we're used to reading in history books. You know, we sometimes start to internalize this idea that our histories don't matter, or that our histories are kind of, you know, a sidebar to the main history of this place, for me in Canada and probably for you in the United States. But when you start to share these stories, and, you know, when I started to learn, for example, my own family's history, and, you know, I don't want to give away kind of the ending,
okay,
but what I learned
no
is
problem.
That, you know, my family, like many other families, had a bit of a secret. And that secret that I ended up learning tells this really, really, really fascinating part of Canada's history that I had known so little about before. And you start to realize that, you know, all of these personal stories, all of these personal histories, really, they're not the sidebar or the kind of, if you're reading the history book, you know, sidebar article 1.1. You know, they are, in fact, they actually tell the main story of a country like Canada, where so many of us are people who would come from away. And when you piece together all of these really kind of fascinating personal stories, that is our country's history. You know, it tells such an important and essential part of our country's history, and is so instructive, I think, in so many ways, and teaches lessons that I think are so relevant, perhaps now more than ever.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for uncovering these stories and prying them out of your father with persistence. And also for going around and uncovering and telling those stories of so many that really, really help illuminate the history of a fascinating cuisine that deserves every bit the attention, you know, that you've given it. And I hope it continues.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, this has been a really sprawling interview, and there's so much we could say.
I feel like I've just been rambling. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, there's just so many facets. You know, I think that that's telling in its own. There's so many facets to your story, to your book, to that is relevant to anything going on in the world of restaurants, really. So, you know, and congratulations to you. I know this book was nominated for an IACP award. So which has been postponed.
Thank you, that's exciting.
Yeah. So the awards will be announced at a later point, but this is really exciting. So I hope everyone gets, and now it's out in the US. I know at first it was only out in Canada. So I hope everyone gets their hands on Chop Suey Nation. It's a fascinating read, it's an important read, and it's a beautiful read. So thank you again, Anne.
Thanks, Kathy.
All right. And thank you, Jeet, our engineer. And we'll see you when we see you on Heritage Radio Network, when we're able to record again. So and thanks, everyone, for keeping everyone safe at the station. And hope everyone stays safe and healthy where you are. Thanks again for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.